Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, May 1st, rabbit, rabbit, as my kids say, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI Sam Houghton, Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent, Jeff Spillane at the Cape Cod Times, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll speak with Jack Spillane at the Standard Times, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and we'll hear from Mike Dean up at the State House. We'll finish off by checking in with WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. WCAI's Sam Houghton starts us off in these busy times with an overview of the latest numbers and information on the local coronavirus response. Hi, Sam.
Morning, Steve.
Sam, bring us up to date on the numbers. We've heard a lot of talk about the surge. What have we seen so far?
So Governor Baker saying this week that numbers are starting to plateau. And we could start to see numbers declining across the state. But that said, we had almost 2,000 new cases today and then another 150 deaths. There's now a total of 62,000 positive tests across the state and 3,500 deaths. But we reported this morning that hospitalizations for COVID-19 have actually declined the last 3 days. So some good news there. Locally, we're up to about 860 cases on the Cape. That's about 150 more than where we were last Friday. There are 3,500 in Bristol County. That's about 1,500 more from last week. And just a few more on Martha's Vineyard. There's now 19 cases. No new cases on Nantucket for the last few days, but they've had a couple new cases this week.
Sam, chambers of commerce are struggling to come up with ways to ease tourist concerns about traveling to the Cape and Islands this summer, while at the same time accommodating local businesses. We had State Senator Julian Sear on Morning Edition earlier today. Tell us what he said about how this may be able to get done.
Yeah, his message was really to have one voice, across the Cape and Islands when it comes to safety and tourism. Earlier this week, there was news that the Chamber of Commerce on Martha's Vineyard, the hospital there, they plan to send out an open letter to tourists and seasonal visitors with guidelines of how to, return to the islands safely. It's really in line with what the governor is asking, that people self-isolate for 14 days after traveling. But they got a little pushback from their members and decided not to send the letter out. And Julian Sear, he says this morning that these lists of guidelines is to have one united voice. And he says there might be visitors out there that don't know about Baker's order that might be coming to the Cape and Islands early now that school is out. And he sent out a news brief with kind of guidelines this morning. They want people to bring enough supplies to last 2 weeks so they don't have to stop at shops locally. They want people to isolate for 2 weeks and are asking that people come, to the Cape and Islands only if necessary. I think what will be interesting to watch next is how the governor will address traveling when the current emergency order is set to expire, and that's kind of later this month.
Now, this week seems to be when a lot of government leaders are starting to talk about creating plans to reopen. Tell us, from the state level down to the local level, how this is beginning to shape up.
Yeah, Governor Baker announced this week that he formed a new task force. It's made up of city mayors, government officials, and business leaders from large and small companies. I think it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. And at the county level, here in Barnstable, Jack Units, he's the county administrator, he announced yesterday that he had formed a similar group. They're charged with coming up with a plan by mid to late May. Around the same time as Governor Baker's order is set to expire. That's the essential business only order. Then we learned something interesting yesterday on the local level. Sandwich public safety officers are using rapid testing where results are kind of finalized in hours versus days. Fire Chief John Burke says that could play into the town's reopening as these kind of rapid tests become more available.
That is WCAI Sam Houghton bringing us up to date this morning, this Friday morning. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
On Martha's Vineyard, an open letter to seasonal residents advising precautions to be taken if they come to the island has been removed from the Chamber of Commerce website. Brian Dowd of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us to explain what's going on here. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Steve.
Brian, tell us about this letter. It was put together with input from the hospital and the state delegation.
Yeah, so on Tuesday, the Martha's Vineyard Chamber of Commerce put up this open letter, you know, that had some guidance for seasonal residents over the coming months. And it was said that it was kind of put together by the Chamber of Commerce, the hospital, and some of the Cape and Islands delegation. But what happened was Oak Bluffs, leaders in Oak Bluffs especially, were unhappy with that because when that letter got posted, that was kind of the first time they saw it. And it turned out that no one had reached out to them quite yet on kind of what should be in that open letter. And so, you know, they were upset about that, and they they asked the chamber to, you know, take that down, and the chamber eventually did. But the letter itself was actually very similar to the letter that the Nantucket Hospital had put out for seasonal residents. It had just kind of been switched out with Martha's Vineyard on it. And
tell us what the letter says. Like, what kind of what are they outlining there for seasonal residents?
Yeah, so it asks seasonal residents to, you know, self-quarantine for 14 days, bring enough supplies for that 14 days, so you can limit your trips outside your house and to the grocery store. But the key thing was that it was asking people to do that throughout the summer. And that's kind of what some of the selectmen and the town administrator in Oak Bluffs were upset about, because they said that kind of has, you know, some unforeseen consequences. And considering how things are, you know, what was happening 30 days ago is completely different from what's happening now, and who knows what's going to happen in the next 30 days. So they said it might have been too early to have any of that kind of guidance for the seasonal residents. And they don't know what that could do to, you know, the economy and things like that.
So then the chamber backed down and took it off the website. But as you said, this letter was actually crafted on there was an almost identical letter that was crafted for Nantucket. What's the sense of what happens now on the Vineyard? Are they going to re-edit this letter a little bit and put it back up, or what happens?
So that's kind of what they're working on now, we're looking to see if you know, all the island towns kind of came together for this construction moratorium they had a couple weeks ago. And I think some people and seasonal residents are kind of looking forward to seeing, you know, if the towns kind of come together and offer, you know, work together again to offer guidance for seasonal residents. But, you know, we'll see.
I know that Denise Shapisi at the hospital says that essentially, you know, for the Vineyard, you're not out of the woods yet, like anywhere, really, and that it's really important to keep an eye on this and to keep sending the message that we need to keep working to stay safe and keep each other safe.
Yeah, so while that letter, you know, got taken down, Denise Shapici actually sent out a statement of her own the following day and kind of doubled down on that and said, you know, this was just to offer guidance, and we want to work, of course, with the towns going forward. But she stressed that, you know, yeah, we're not out of the woods yet, and this is kind of far from over.
That is Brian Dowd of the Martha's Vineyard Times joining us. Brian, thanks for that.
Thanks, Steve.
Schools across the region have been wrestling with the challenges of switching to remote learning. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us for a look at how some of them are doing. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, your reporter looked at the Monomoy Regional District, where there are other changes to take in as well, as the superintendent has announced that he's leaving.
It's actually the principal of Monomoy Regional High School.
High school principal, I'm sorry, yes.
Sure. Yeah, Bill Burkhead, who's he opened that school when it was brand new 6 years ago. He announced this week that at the end of June, he'll be leaving to become superintendent of schools in Scituate. And, you know, Birkhead, he's really credited with taking Chatham and Harwich High Schools and, you know, two distinct, you know, really rivals for many decades and blending them into one cohesive culture at Monomoy High. He really took the reins and did a great job at that. And he's been widely recognized for that work. He was named in 2018 the Massachusetts Principal of the Year by the Secondary School Administrators Association. And, you know, he said this week in an interview with us that these 6 years at Monomoy were his best, the best years in his professional career, he said. And obviously he's going to miss the folks here. But he said, you know, he felt that he was ready for the next step and the Scituate job was a good fit. And so pending contract negotiations, he'll be off to that new job beginning on July 1st.
And you got a chance to talk to him about how remote learning is going right now. Tell us a little bit about what you heard.
Well, you know, the Governor Baker's announcement this week that schools will be closed for the rest of the school year really wasn't a surprise, I think, probably to most educators. And at least at the Monomoy District, they were really prepared for that. We talked to a number of educators there. Superintendent of School Scott Carpenter said that you know, he had it in his mind that this was going to happen. And so they're sort of tweaking their model for distance learning to accommodate that. Now, the one interesting thing is we also talked to the superintendent of schools at Cape Cod Tech in Harwich. Superintendent Robert Sanborn said that, you know, they're doing the same sort of distance learning that everybody else is doing. The difference is that obviously with the technical education, you can't add that those shop components, the really hard hands-on technical learning. You can't do that remotely. So that's been a real gap for students at that school. What Mr. Sanborn told us was that they are kind of doubling down on talking about things like theory behind these hands-on skills, improving safety skills, and also talking about the academic components that go into a lot of these technical programs, you know, math, how that feeds into carpentry and things like that. So they're really trying to make up for that as best they can, but it's not easy, you know.
You can imagine for those technical schools, this is an especially hard thing to try to work around, to work remotely.
Sure. And, you know, the longer it goes on, the harder it's going to be for those kids, I think, to catch up. And that's what both Scott Carpenter and Bob Sanborn said, that, you know, no matter how good they do at the distance learning, there's going to be an education gap for this sort of cohort of students. And their hope is that they can sort of make up those gaps in the fall when kids go back to school. They can identify, you know, what they need to know to move on to those next grades and cover that stuff early in the school year next year. So they've already started to think about that and how social distancing might work with the schools. But they're not convinced, I think, even that they're going to go back to school in the fall. So I think they're making contingency plans for that.
Mm. That is Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle joining us for a look at how some of the schools are taking on the challenges of teaching remotely right now. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. Provincetown's health director said requiring masks on Commercial Street wasn't necessary. The select board disagreed. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us with the story. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Ed,
good.
There are a number of parts to this story that make it kind of a microcosm of how we're all discussing a response to the pandemic these days. Tell us what's happened here.
Well, this was something that happened on Monday at the Provincetown Select Board meeting. one of the interesting aspects of it is that it wasn't even on the agenda for the board, but it came up as a result of several comments from members of the public and letters and a sort of a Facebook situation where there was a lot of posts of people being upset about seeing others on Commercial Street in Provincetown not wearing masks. And the board voted 3-2 to require masks in all Provincetown businesses and by everyone outdoors on Commercial Street between Bangs Street and Pleasant Street, which is like a 1 mile long section right in the center of Provincetown. And that requirement starts today, May 1st. And as you mentioned, the health director, Morgan Clark, and both chair and vice chair of the Board of Health in Provincetown were advised against this rule, saying it wasn't really necessary.
Explain that a little bit. What's their thinking there when they say it wasn't really necessary?
Well, the vice chair of the health board is Dr. Susan Troyan. She's actually a cancer surgeon. And she feels that people in Provincetown are already complying quite well with all of the health advisories, and that the best course really is just public education and letting people know what are the best practices as far as social distancing, et cetera, that making rules is not the best way to get people to comply. I'm sure that part of the issue is just how do you enforce these rules? And what the select board seems to be suggesting is that it's up to businesses to enforce them in their own establishments. And it's not clear what will happen outdoors on the street. Are the police going to have to be involved? Those questions haven't been answered. Even the select board was split on this, with two of the five members voting against it. One of them, apparently just because of the way it was brought up and not on the agenda. And that was also a question that was raised by one of the local business people, Rob Anderson, who is one of the owners of the canteen restaurant. Said he's for the idea of requiring masks, but it seemed like they're just making policy on the fly here on the basis of one conversation rather than really thinking about it. I also there's so many different issues here. Yesterday I followed up by talking to Dr. Michael Stein, who has this summer place here in Truro, but he's the chair of the Health Law Policy and Management Department at Boston University School of Public Health. And I asked him what he thought about this idea of, you know, towns requiring masks. And he said he's for the idea of masks. He thinks it is a good idea, but there's a lot of questions. And the biggest one is, what do you mean by a mask? He said, if we all had really good masks, like those, you know, N95 masks that medical frontline people need, he said, there's no doubt that everybody should be wearing masks indoors. The problem is, if you don't have a good mask, if you're not cleaning it every single day, then it's not as clear that it's really helping very much. And outdoors, it's even trickier to say, you know, who really needs a mask outdoors? If you're able to stay distant from others, it's not clear that a mask is going to really make any difference at all. So there's a lot of unanswered questions here. And at the same time, people are saying, well, we need to do everything we can to get control of this.
It's a discussion we're going to be hearing a lot more of. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Thanks, Ed, for that.
You're very welcome. Nice to talk to you, Steve.
The Barnstable County Administrator is crying foul after neighboring Plymouth County claimed a $90 million distribution of federal money. Jeff Spillane of the Cape Cod Times landed this story, and he joins us now. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Jeff, I had to read this two or three times to make sure I was getting it right. $90 million. And I guess many people are saying that this is money that should be going to the state. Explain what this is about.
Sure. This $150 billion, as we all know, on the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. That's the Federal CARES Act program, which is providing funds to states to help account for unbudgeted and unexpected costs due to the COVID-19 crisis. But as part of the rules for applying for this funding, Steve, you can apply if you are a local government with 500,000 people or more. And Plymouth County just happens to have 521,000 people. They were just barely made the cutoff, as opposed to Barnstable, which was 213,000 people. We couldn't even apply. And there are about five counties in the state that met that 500,000 population requirement. And it was understood and just agreed upon that, you know what, since 7.5 of the state's 12 million people live outside of these counties, it should go into one pot for the state to administer, except for Plymouth County. They decided, well, you know what, we're going to keep that money here, and we're going to administer it ourselves. And that, of course, has raised the ire of people on Beacon Hill and the governor's administration, as well as other counties, Barnstable and Norfolk included.
There must be a huge amount of challenges to a place like Plymouth County with just a little over 500,000 people administering a $90 million grant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you think about it, the budget of Plymouth County is about 25%, about a quarter of what the budget is here in smaller Barnstable County, simply because we have a lot more services that we offer here in Barnstable County to our population, whether it be health, human services, environmental, the dredge program. Plymouth County, pretty much their responsibility is maintaining three courthouses and the Registry of Deeds. And so it has just been bewildering as to why they want to keep this money. Jack Units, our county administrator in Barnstable, said this is outrageous. Plymouth County apparently didn't get the message from the governor that we are all in this together.
What are the Plymouth County officials saying to all of this?
Well, I spoke with the administrator of Plymouth County. I did reach him. He's recovering from COVID-19, actually. And I did speak with the chairman of the Plymouth County Board of Commissioners, who said, well, you know, Barnstable, we don't tell you how to run your business and vice versa. But the governor's office, the administration, Office of Finance and Administration, has given Plymouth County pretty much an ultimatum and a deadline of today, May 1st, saying you need to tell us what you're going to do. You keep that money, that's fine, but you're going to assume all responsibility to the United States Treasury, and you're going to accept all compliance risk, including paying that money back if they determine it's not distributed correctly or it's improperly spent. In other words, you're on your own. Also, Plymouth County, moving forward, we don't know when we're going to come out of this crisis. If there are funds that the state will need to spend for your residents and cities and towns in the county, we're going to bill you for that. On the other hand, you could decide, like the other counties have, and provide that money to the state, put it into the pool of funds, which we have a large staff and the infrastructure to administer, and you will not be indemnified. And plus, we're better positioned to manage those.
Mm-hmm. Is there a timeline that they're working against here, that they have to make a decision, Plymouth?
Today.
Oh, okay.
Today. May 1st. All right. So we will be following up and listening to... There's also another concern here, Steve, that what Plymouth County is doing may actually reignite the debate as to whether county governments are an unnecessary layer of government here in Massachusetts, and there's a lot of fear about that, considering that I believe it's 4 out of the 14 counties actually have some type of government operations right now. The rest of them are gone.
And Jeff Spillane of the Cape Cod Times, thanks for joining us with that story.
Hey, thank you.
Officials at Nantucket Airport are not happy after the Federal Aviation Administration announced that it's cutting hours for the control tower during the busiest times. Josh Balling joins us now from the Inquirer and Mirror. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, that summary sounds like it doesn't make sense. Cutting hours at the busiest time, What's going on?
Well, it certainly doesn't make sense to Nantucket Memorial Airport officials, pilots, and passengers who fly into and out of Nantucket Memorial Airport. I think part of the problem stems from the fact that Nantucket's busiest times may not be the busiest times of other airports, potentially around the nation, and this might have been a one-size-fits-all initiative of the FAA. But starting next week, one way or the other, the air traffic control tower at Nantucket Memorial Airport is not going to be available to guide flights during Nantucket's busiest times, which are between 7 and 8 in the morning and 4 and 6 in the afternoon. Under the new schedule that the FAA has implemented when they announced plans last week to slash hours of operation at towers across the country, the tower will only be open from 8 to 4 daily instead of 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. Airport officials have pushed back against this decision. They cite safety concerns, obviously, and, you know, again, those busiest hours. But the FAA hasn't moved. It's going to go into effect Monday or Tuesday. Airport officials are quick to stress to the few passengers at the moment who are flying in and out of Nantucket that the risk of an accident remains low. They have full faith in the pilots and the aircraft that fly in and out of Nantucket Airport, but even a slightly higher risk spread across in what promises to be an increasing number of operations as the summer gets closer is a concern. The FAA has told the airport that they plan to increase air traffic control hours on Memorial Day weekend, but it's not clear by how much, and there are no indications that that will continue any further into the summer.
Mm. We don't have a whole lot of time, but I want to ask you about a couple other stories on the island. A drive-in movie theater may be coming to Bartlett's Farm. This seems like such a creative response to the limitations of physical distancing these days.
Definitely a creative response. It certainly is. The Dreamland Theater, which has a brick-and-mortar theater downtown Nantucket, and Bartlett's Ocean View Farm have joined forces to potentially show drive-in movies nightly in the parking lot of the farm this summer. The Dreamland is going to be closed downtown, obviously, for the foreseeable future, and will have to be abide by social distancing guidelines when it reopens. So it is working on a plan to put up a temporary, but at least permanently for the summer, drive-in movie screen in the parking lot of the farm, and allow people to drive in and watch movies. There will be a place for pedestrians as well, as long as they abide by social distancing guidelines, to watch films. The Bartlett still and Bartlett's in the Dreamland still have to work out some licensing and some approval issues with the town before this moves forward, but they're confident they can get those hammered out. There has been a little bit of pushback. A couple of neighbors have expressed concern about the potential noise and light pollution and some other concerns, but right now this seems to be a generally positive feedback so far on whether this will move forward, and they hope to do it for Memorial Day weekend right through September and then potentially continue it into the future summers.
Mm. Hey, Josh, just to mention, the long run has come to a finish. Two new positives of coronavirus this week after three straight weeks of no new confirmed cases on the island. What's it feel like there right now?
Well, the long run did come to an end, 22 straight days with no new cases, but a new streak has started. Nantucket, as of yesterday evening, was back up to three straight days with no new cases. So something of an anomaly, I guess, but hospital officials and public health officials will tell you certainly that the much greater anomaly was the fact that there was not a single case in 22 straight days, even given the limited number of tests that Nantucket was conducting and the isolation and social distancing guidelines that Nantucketers were obviously following pretty well. They were surprised that there hadn't been a couple of cases spread out in among those 3 weeks. So not a surprise necessarily. And again, 3 days and counting with no new cases on Nantucket. So hospital public health officials or town officials very pleased about that.
Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We hear about the challenges being faced by local doctors and nurses caring for people with COVID-19. Jack Spillane of the Standard Times joins us now to talk about a remarkable look behind the scenes at St. Luke's Hospital in New Bedford. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Steve.
Jack, this article and the pictures that go with it, which are fabulous, really provides an exceptional look at what's going on in the hospital now. Tell us a little bit about what your reporter found.
Well, it's very interesting. A lot of the credit goes to Pete Pereira, our wonderful photographer, who gained access to taking these breathtaking shots of hospital workers treating COVID-19 patients. Kiernan Dunlop, our reporter, did a terrific job of talking to some of the first responders and healthcare workers. On the South Coast, Steve, we have had not as high a rate of coronavirus as some of the other parts of the states, but there are 43 patients there. And what they found was nurses in particular that are playing the role of family that can't go in and see their own loved ones. So you have people talking about holding people's hands while they died, or a loved one requesting that they say a prayer for someone. It's just an incredible look. Another thing that was quite moving is the burden of wearing all this personal protective gear. They talk about the healthcare workers coming out of patients' rooms and sweating and just really having marks on their face from the gear they're wearing. They also talk about the nurses coming up with an innovative system for keeping the patient visits to a minimum, so that they have like things like the IV poles outside the room with longer tubes going in. It's a whole new way of healthcare, and it's really quite something.
One of the things that one of the nurses mentions, or and the doctors there, they talk about how dehumanizing it is to try to care for these people who are in tremendous need while you're wearing all this equipment, and people can't even see the expression on your face as you're working with them and trying to provide them encouragement.
Yes, there was one nurse who talked about she smiles. She tells the patients that she's smiling through her mask. I think that's just quite remarkable. And you're dealing with patients that can't respond that much themselves because they're intubated. They also talked about the big victory they had when they were able to remove the ventilator from the first patient that they knew was going to get better, and how encouraging that was to these healthcare workers. And remarkably, they say most of them, the morale is good. They do have enough PPE at St. Luke's. That was not the case in the very beginning, but now they do. So I think that has been encouraging to some of the healthcare workers.
It is a remarkable photo essay and a very nice article. I encourage folks to go find that on the Standard Times and take a look at what's happening at St. Luke's Hospital in New Bedford. Jack Spillane of the Standard Times, thanks for joining us.
Nice talking to you, Steve.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. On Monday, some construction and landscaping work resumed on Martha's Vineyard, and it brought the sight of passengers disembarking the ferry without face masks. Reporter Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette joins us now to talk about the rather heated conversation that the image sparked. Hiya, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, this story has been advancing all week. Yesterday, it took another step forward. This is the Vineyard's, the Steamship Authority's response to all of this. Tell us where we're at now, and then we can kind of fill in the story here.
Yeah, sure. So as it stands right now, the Steamship has sort of reversed course, and they've said that they are going to require passengers to wear face coverings while aboard the vessel. And basically, to get around legal loopholes, they've come up with this sort of they've come up with kind of a workaround that says, you don't have to wear one to get on, but if you don't wear one, then there might be consequences. And those consequences can include sort of getting queued for boarding onto the vessel separately from everyone else, being sequestered into a different part of the vessel, maybe having to even take a different boat, or staying in your car. So as it stands, also they're requiring employees to wear masks as well. So as it stands now, the messaging is very clear. You're wearing a mask when you get on the ferry, and if not, then there may be consequences.
but not
what it always was.
Yes. To explain how this kind of unrolled this week.
Well, this all sort of started with a photo that was in the Gazette, and we thought it would probably be a good idea to send one of our photographers down to the Steamship on Monday morning, just because we knew there were going to be workers coming from off island. This was the day that the island was relaxing its construction ban. 1-2-man crews were going to be allowed to go back to work. So photographer goes down there, takes a photo. We put up a story later in the day about a new case on the island, and we include the photo in it. And then it kind of blew up from there, because on Tuesday morning, there was a press briefing that the hospital gives out, and the hospital CEO had seen the photo, and she said that she was shocked and dismayed by seeing people disembark from the ferry without masks. And the photo pretty much just, if anyone hasn't seen it, it showed about maybe 12 people coming off the ferry, you know, many of them wearing masks, a lot of them not wearing masks, but everyone was kind of bunched together. Clearly social distancing wasn't really followed. And then things kind of snowballed too, because a lot of other organizations, such as the island's VTA, which is the island bus system, Cape Air, and then some of the island towns, also started all like kind of in a line, like dominoes, forcing, or, you know, saying you're going to have to wear face coverings in public or on our transportation. So pressure started to sort of mount on the Steamship Authority, but their policy, I think, according to them, they were kind of hamstrung by what they could do, which made things complicated as the week progressed.
Well, the island, Martha's Vineyard, has been so, the numbers on the island have been so contained, and it seems to be
right.
Working. Whatever's going on in the island right now seems to be working in terms of keeping coronavirus and COVID-19 down. It seems like they're really concerned about opening, giving it an opening here, and or not.
That's
giving
true.
It an opening,
and,
I should say, yeah.
You're right, and I think the sort of perspective on it is that the steamship is it's the main connector and go-between the mainland and the island. And if you look at cases in Barnstable County, they're just much higher. And I think one of the reasons, you know, maybe not, it wasn't the only reason, but one of the reasons sort of in the back of selectmen's minds when they instituted the construction ban was, hey, if, you know, if people are coming from off-island, that presents a whole nother level of worry for islanders. And as the construction bans have sort of relaxed and traffic on the steamship has picked up, the sort of pressure to have face coverings for people getting on and off the vessel has increased as well. And so they all kind of went hand in hand, and it was like this perfect storm this week. And I think the steamship, for a while, could say, hey, there's a legal issue here. We can't institute face coverings unless the governor says we have to or the Coast Guard says we have to. But as the pressure kind of mounted, it became like, well, how can we do this working within the sort of constraints that we do have? And it seems like they've figured out a way, at least last night. that's what became clear. But it was a total saga throughout the week.
And reporter,
you know, kept growing and growing. Yeah.
Reporter Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, Steve.
Governor Baker has been plenty busy with his daily press briefings and visits to field hospitals, testing sites, and other duties. But what are the top Democrats in the legislature up to? WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean for the weekly update.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning.
Okay, so before we get to the legislature, Mike, I want to talk about news from the governor this week. As we all know, he announced that non-essential businesses will be closed through May 18th. Not a big surprise, given that we are still in this pandemic, but Governor Charlie Baker did convene a task force to plan the state's reopening. Tell us a little bit about who is in that group.
It's a lot of large and small business leaders around the state, and it's kind of important to know that, you know, when Baker puts these task forces together, it's not just window dressing for, you know, the state not really taking action. Baker does like to use these blue ribbon commissions to bring folks together and really execute on the plan that he makes them develop. So they are due to put a plan forward by May 18th, and like I said, it's mostly large and small business leaders from around Massachusetts geographically. It's headed up by Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito and the Housing and Economic Development Secretary Mike Keneally, and they're going to deliver a phased-in plan for how the state can reopen businesses going forward. And the plan is likely to take a look at businesses that can succeed and do so safely in this kind of interim time that we're looking at. You're going to see certain sectors opening up as the task force gives approval and sees, you know, what can operate safely and how guidelines can come down. Because I think a lot of this is going to come down to which businesses can maintain social distancing, can you know, keep things safe for their employees and the public, and operate in a way that will be successful for them.
And one industry that's come up already in these conversations is the daycare or childcare industry. Of course, a critical industry for a lot of working parents, but are some challenges with getting that going because of the fact that it's really hard to social distance with small children.
Right. And this is a point that Senate President Karen Spilka brought up when she said that, you know, when we're going to reopen, childcare needs to be one of the first things considered because you can't open up businesses in an equitable way without providing childcare for those employees. You know, schools are still going to be closed throughout the summer and daycare centers, any kind of childcare facility is going to become crucial to getting employees back on the job in some way, shape or form. The problem here is how do you operate a daycare center safely under pandemic circumstances? We know that, you know, children aren't necessarily very vulnerable to this illness. However, the employees are certainly going to be, and the children could be vectors for the virus. So the question here and the guidelines that need to be worked out from the state are, you know, what is the safe way to operate a daycare center? Because without child care, you can't really open up wide sectors of the economy the way that the Baker administration wants to.
I also think it's interesting, going back to the makeup of the panel itself, there was some pushback this week from labor groups saying that there isn't enough or any union representation on this task force that is basically just businesses.
Right. Now, Baker addressed this in one of his daily briefings, and it's true, the 17-member board does not really include any labor representative at all. The way Baker describes it is that he wanted to limit the number of people on the task force to help them move more smoothly, to kind of not get bogged down in bureaucratic process. However, the concern here is that there's no one looking out for the employees, and it's really just a task force made up of employers. When Baker was asked about this, he said that the way the task force is supposed to operate is that each task force member would be responsible for their portion, their sector of the economy. So if someone is in charge of the retail sector, that task force member would work with retail labor organizations to work up some kind of a plan and an agreement to then bring into the report that's due on May 18th. That gives a lot of power to these board members, these employer representatives, to kind of speak on behalf and supposedly consider the perspective of their employees, labor. And so this is kind of an ongoing concern. And I guess we'll just have to see in this report and how this board operates, how seriously they're taking the concerns of employees when they issue this in May.
Okay, now I want to turn to the House and Senate. Some news out of the House this week that an effort to allow lawmakers to vote online was held up by just one dissenter.
Yes, that one representative was Representative Bradley Jones, who is the Republican leader, the minority leader in the House. He's held that position for an awfully long time, longer even than House Speaker Robert DeLeo has been in his current position. In order for them to pass a major borrowing bill, and really in order for the House to pass any kind of major legislation that has to do with borrowing or the budget that's very, very crucial in this pandemic crisis, they need to hold a formal session where every member votes on the record. They can't do that with social distancing in place. You can't have 160 members crowd into the House chamber during a pandemic. So what they tried to do was pass emergency rules to allow for remote voting for the first time in the House's history. However, the rules as presented by Robert DeLeo were not satisfactory to the Republican caucus. Their leader, Brad Jones, stopped that rule package from going through. Any member can put the brakes on something. This rule package was blocked, and they need to come up with some alternative way to appease Republicans and some progressive Democrats who also found some of DeLeo's plans objectionable in the early stages.
And of course, there are some big agenda items on their list, as you said, you know, lawmakers needing really to get to a budget for the next fiscal year, which is fast approaching. And there's so much uncertainty now with kind of the bottom falling out of the economy.
That is the concern. We have a $3.5 billion rainy day fund that is kind of built for a recession, not necessarily built for a pandemic crisis. The budget gap we're looking at could be between $4 and $6 billion just because of the immediate impact of the crisis, not necessarily the impact of what could be an 18-month recession after that. So lawmakers are really looking at what this budget needs to be. They're looking at far more spending on things like unemployment and, of course, healthcare in the interim. Spending is probably going to go up. Tax revenues are hitting rock bottom because of everyone staying in. The state is in a very difficult position right now. That's where the borrowing comes in. And so these are a lot of the things that need to happen. The fact that the House has now taken kind of a partisan split where Republicans are resisting what they're calling a power grab from Democratic leader Robert DeLeo is a sign that things are going to be kind of a bumpy road as they navigate the budgetary and fiscal side of this crisis.
And that's WCAI Statehouse reporter Mike Dean talking with us from Boston. Mike, thanks.
Thank you.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean there. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Barnstable County has the highest population of seniors in the state. More than 28% of Cape residents are 65 or older. And in this time of social distancing, WCAI's Eve Zuckoff has been reporting on the impact that isolation can have, particularly on this population. She joins me now. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, you spoke to a number of people going through this pandemic alone. Tell us, what did you hear from them?
Yeah, I spoke with a few women who have been living alone for the last 8 weeks. And really, so two basically told me that their husbands had recently died, one just this past December. Another woman in her 70s broke up with her longtime partner in the fall. And basically, they were saying any anxiety, loneliness, depression they were already feeling because life events were unfolding before all of this was compounded by isolation. So to cope, a number of them were turning on all the TVs in their house all day because they couldn't stand the silence. Others admitted they were taking kind of superfluous trips to pick up food that they just because they needed to see people. And in the quiet moments, I heard from one woman in her 90s who was talking about the fact that, you know, at 94, this might be the way her life ended in isolation. And really just the emotional toll of all of this was so high for these people.
And there are even worries about health effects of isolation and loneliness.
That's absolutely right. There is an increased risk for cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, dementia, malnutrition. I mean, the list goes on. It's very real.
So tell us, what kind of resources are out there to help?
Well, the good news is there are a lot, especially here on the Cape, because the councils on aging in each town across the region have doubled down on programs to proactively reach at-risk seniors. So, for example, at the Barnstable Senior Center, for example, groups of five trade off calling one person each week. It's called the Circle of Friends. And we also know our local Samaritans chapter runs a free and confidential senior outreach program that's already connected around 70 seniors with volunteers who talk with them on the phone each week. And on our website at capeandislands.org, we have many more therapeutic and kind of community-oriented resources to help seniors and any others, actually, who are feeling isolated.
Eve, what was your sense after talking to these folks? Do you feel like that they are finding ways to connect?
I think so. I mean, we spoke with one woman in her 80s who spends, it sounds like, hours on the phone or on Zoom every day. There are ways, and people are doubling down on their phone calls, and they're feeling really grateful for the friends that they do have. But it's certainly a need among the many needs that so many people have right now that's really a challenge to get met. A few women said they identified with this feeling of skin hunger, of missing the feeling of just someone to touch their arm.
Eve, we have to leave it there. That's WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Steve.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank all my guests and a big thanks as ever to Dan Tridle back at the studio, the lone crew in the otherwise empty ship that is our radio station right now. And thanks to my family for keeping the ruckus to a minimum while we're on the air. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.